we think sounds are about the best way of communicating there is. Now sit back and listen.
From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
We've assembled a collection of typical sound.
What you hear is
sound.
Three-dimensional
sound.
It's an experiment. You might have an idea, like footsteps, tweaking it. And then there's abstract sound that approach music.
Sound.
They make a mood.
Sound.
It is sound that surrounds you.
Sounds like we're going to be exploring sounds in this hour, doesn't it? You're right. We'll explore the soundscapes of our lives and imaginations. We'll meet the electronic music composer Suzanne Chani and listen to the sounds of capitalism, also known as advertising music. And we'll investigate mongrel vibrations, the legendary horror writer H.P. Lovecraft's weird ecology of noise. But first, Bernie Krause. Krause started out as a musician. He was a member of the legendary folk group The Weavers. Then he got involved in electronic music. He also made music and effects for feature films such as Rosemary's Baby and Apocalypse Now. But Krause found his true calling as a naturalist and soundscape artist. He's recorded the sounds of all kinds of creatures and environments all over the world for more than 40 years, and he's written a book about his experiences. It's called The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places. And Strange Champs talks to Bernie Krause about his recordings.
Well, I'm going to play an example of one of the soundscapes you brought in. Right now, we're listening to a recording that you made in the Amazon, and I wonder if you could just tell us what we're hearing.
What we're hearing right now is an example of the Amazon night. It's smack in the middle of the Amazon at a research station called Kilometer 41. And my late partner and I, a gal from Harvard, Ruth Happel, were walking down this path late one night. It was around midnight. We smelled the scent of this jaguar, which Ruth, my colleague, understood right away. And it was scent marking as it was going along. We couldn't hear it or see it, but we sure could smell it. And it was following us down the path wherever we went. We went a couple of miles down the path there in the dark. And finally, we got to a split in the path, and Ruth went off in one direction, I went off in the other, and the jaguar kept following me. And at one point, I set up my mics. I have a 30-foot cable on my mics, and I set up my mics. The microphone on the stand was at one end, and I was at the other. And I turned on my recorder, and all of a sudden, the sound of this jaguar breathing right into the mic. It stepped right up to the microphone.
That's a terrifying sound when you hear it. You hear that sound and you think, big predator.
It was a big predator, and it scared me to death. But there I was, and the only thing that you can do is be very quiet. You don't want to shine a flashlight on it to startle it, and you don't want to do much movement, because that's what they're attracted to.
One of the things that's most interesting in your book is the way you describe animals as kind of like radio broadcasters, in that different species use different bandwidths or different channels to broadcast their communications.
What's interesting about them is that they each find their own niche to vocalize, each species. In other words, they have to have their own bandwidth and find their own bandwidth in order to be heard. Otherwise, if their voices are masked and their lives depend on vocal behavior in part, it's really important that they have these channels. It's just like television channels, channel 4, channel 6, channel 5, and so on. Each of these broadcast bandwidth frequencies is really important for the structure of each animal. And in every habitat, all of the animals find their own niche in which to vocalize. Animals vocalize in relationship to one another, much like instruments in an orchestra, either competitive or cooperative. And different animals maintain their own bandwidth in the acoustic spectrum. For instance, most of the mammals sing in the very lowest range. the birds sing in the next range up. Then the insects and the frogs and the very highest creatures, of course, which includes insects, but also the bats have the highest voice in the land-based animal kingdom, and also the dolphins and whales in the marine environment. They also have the very highest pitch sounds. So that's how that works. And those structures are very important because the animal voices have to stay out of each other's way in order to be heard and in order for the animals to thrive in any environment. And that's what we call the biophony. It's the collective sound made up by all of these organisms in a given habitat. And it's really important to understand that the soundscape is a narrative that expresses itself over a broad spectrum, not only of the animals, but a broad spectrum of disciplines as well, because there's a lot of information in that. And you can see that when you do a spectrogram, which is a graphic illustration of sound.
What do you mean there's a lot of information in there?
When you listen to any soundscape, a natural soundscape, you're listening to information that tells you about biology, about resource management, medicine, religion, natural history, architecture, literature, physics, and many, many others. For instance, people have asked me, why do you do this? Well, partly because I suffer from a terrible case of ADHD. I've always had this as a kid, and I have it as an adult, and I'm not much into medication. So the only thing that calms me down is going out into the natural world and listening to these creatures and being quiet enough for long periods of time and just shutting up and listening to things. I can't rustle my clothes. I can't move around and shuffle my feet around. I've got to sit very quietly for long periods of time, and that's what this has taught me to do. So in terms of healing and a certain kind of medicine, that's one thing the soundscape does. It also speaks to us about religion. For instance, it's the natural soundscape from which we acquired spirituality. That was the voice of the divine for us for so many years while we lived closely connected to the natural world.
I guess what I'm wondering is to be able to hear or to decode the information in a soundscape the way you do. Is there an example we could play of a soundscape, and you tell us what you hear with your much more experienced, more trained ears?
Well, we don't even need necessarily a trained ear. There are two examples that you have. One is before and after selective logging, Lincoln mm-hmm. Meadow.
Mm-hmm.
What we have here is an example of the effects of selective logging, which is really obvious to everybody. I mean, we don't have to go through a whole course in biology or bioacoustics to understand this one. In 1988, I was approached by a logging company up in the Sierras, a place just north of Truckee, a small town on the California-Nevada border. We were told that there was going to be no biological effect from selective logging that would be a problem, that all of the creatures would still be there, the biota of that particular environment would still remain the same, and the biome would be very healthy. So I said to them, fine, can I record before you do the logging and then after the logging to see if there are any changes? There should be no changes if there's no effect, if you're ensuring us that there's no effect. And they said, fine, go ahead and do that. So I went and recorded in 1988, and this is the recording of what that place sounded like before selective logging. Okay, now let's listen to what happened a year after selective logging and 15 times subsequent. We've been up there recording at different years, all at the same time on the 21st of June under this pretty much the same weather conditions. Listen to this.
That's very different.
Isn't it amazing? In a way, it's really sad because there's almost nothing there, and all the density and diversity has shifted. It's all gone now.
Wow. I was thinking that, of course, what you and I might hear, you know, sitting in the middle of a jungle or any landscape, isn't necessarily what the non-human inhabitants hear. We've been talking about what we hear, but what do animals hear?
Well, animals hear different things. Insects will certainly hear within one range that they've evolved to hear. Same thing with the frogs and the birds, because they hear differently too. They're listening for certain kinds of signals that convey to them that it's a safe habitat. When people are closely connected to that natural world environment of theirs, we hear things differently because we learn to hear in a very discriminating way. For instance, when I was working in the Amazon with the Jivaro, a tribe that lives in the Amazon basin, after a period of time that I'd been there, I was there for nearly a month, I was invited to go off one evening on a hunt with them, and they hunt with blowguns and arrows. What was astonishing to me is when you walk through the jungle, it's very dark because the canopy overhead shuts out the stars, and they don't take any torches or any light with them. They just walk through the forest, and I'm stumbling over the leaves and branches and stuff on the ground. They just walk very quietly. How do they do that? Well, they use the natural soundscape around them, the biophony. They use the biophony as an oral GPS. In other words, they walk through these grids of sound, and they know exactly where they are in this forest. Not only that, but the slight changes in soundscape convey to them what animal is up the path, like about a quarter of a mile, what kind of animal it is, what direction it's heading in, and whether or not it's worth a hunt. And,
wow.
And they pick up all this information from the soundscape, from that biophony.
So it's a kind of sound map.
It's absolutely a sound map to them. But not only that, here's the key, Anne. The key is that the humans who live closely connected to that natural world environment, like the Bayaka in the Central African Republic, or the Jivaro in the Amazon, or the Kalali in New Guinea, Papua New Guinea, they use the biophony as a natural karaoke orchestra with which they perform. In other words, it's their backup band. And they burst into song as a result of what they hear in the soundscape during the course of any day.
So this is part of your theory that human music has its roots, its origins, in the soundscapes of the natural world?
Exactly right.
Bernie, what's the saddest vocalization you've ever heard?
Well, a colleague of mine from Minnesota, a fellow named Kurt Olson, sent me this recording that was made at a beaver pond that he had been spending many years at recording, and it was in a very remote spot in Minnesota. And he tells the story of having been recording there one day, and a couple of state fish and wildlife guys came in with a stick of dynamite, and they dropped it down the beaver dam. And this was in the spring, and they blew up the dam, killing the female and the offspring. And he stayed there all day, and he was so devastated by seeing this whole habitat destroyed with one explosion. And there was no reason for the guys to do that because the beaver dam wasn't obstructing any farmland or anything like that. It wasn't impeding any agriculture. But he stayed there, and that night he recorded the male beaver that he observed was wounded swimming in these circles around this pond looking for its mate and its offspring. And I have to tell you, that's the saddest sound I've ever heard in my life.
Bernie, near the end of your book, you write that it is possible for us to learn to listen in more informed way, that we can learn to listen in a completely involved, active, rather than passive way. How can we learn to do that?
I have only one thing to tell people about that. Just be quiet. They got to shut up. There's a guy by the name of James Watt, who was Ronald Reagan's Secretary of the Interior. And he made a very profound statement once. He said, noise is power. And the noisier we are as a culture, Americans, he was talking about, the more powerful we appear to be to others. Isn't that interesting? So if we shut up a little bit and we'll be real quiet and we listen to these sounds of the natural world, we're going to feel better. It's like Richard Louv wrote in Last Child in the Woods. He said, we're suffering as a culture from nature deficit disorder. And part of that nature deficit disorder, a thing that he's you know, drawn into his own thesis now, is the lack of natural soundscape, which is disappearing very fast. 50% of my archive, I have 4,500 hours in my archive, 50% of my archive that I've recorded since 1968, 44 years ago, 50% is now gone. It's extinct. You can't hear it anymore. The only place you'll hear it is in my archive.
Bernie Kraus is the author of The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Do you have a favorite sound in nature? We'd love to know what it is. You can let us know via Facebook or Twitter, or you can send us an email through our website, ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. We've heard the sounds of jaguars, birds, and beavers. Now, try imagining the sounds of hideous, monstrous beings which are so strange that no language can properly describe them. Dean Lockwood is a senior lecturer in media theory at the University of Lincoln in the United Kingdom. He's also the author of an essay called Mongrel Vibrations, H.P. Lovecraft's Weird Ecology of Noise. Lockwood talks about the central role that sound plays in H.P. Lovecraft's weird fiction.
In Lovecraft stories, there's a lot of attention given to the possibility that our exposure to certain weird things in the world will drive us insane. There's that element of insanity. But I think that Lovecraft is perhaps more interested in our bodily responses to horror, affect. So he talks about the way in which sounds, for example, have a kind of physical impact. He describes sounds that are not really sounds, that are something else. He describes them as sense impacts. So I think rather than sound, Lovecraft is really interested in vibration, in some kind of alien vibration flooding our bodies.
And you say that Lovecraft actually defined the weird in sonic terms. What was it exactly that he said?
He says that we should understand the weird as an attitude of awed listening, as if we were listening for the beating of black wings or some kind of scratching at the edge of the known universe.
That's scary, isn't it?
It is.
Sound somehow brings it home. We've all felt vibrations and wondered about them.
That's right. When we see something, it's as if we master it. We have some kind of protection. We're distant from it. Vision seems to presuppose a certain distance from the phenomenon that we're witnessing. But with sound and this vibratory aspect of sound, it moves through us, it's proximate, it's within us. So you can't stand back from a sonic horror. It floods you, it sweeps through your body.
You also refer to the fantasy writer Fritz Lieber, who thought that Lovecraft was the Copernicus of horror fiction.
Yeah, because he turns everything around. For Lovecraft, the horror is really the cosmos that we find within ourselves. It's the black gulf, the interstellar gulf within humanity. There's something non-human, something alien that's at the heart of our existence. And all of his best stories, I think, are encounters with this otherness, this weirdness within.
Well, let's talk about some of the stories, because it's the best way to define it. One of his most famous is called The Call of... This is a word that everybody disagrees on the pronunciation of.
Sure.
I've always said Cthulhu. Is that close?
I would say Cthulhu, yeah. So these words are a nice device for alienating us from our own speech, our own language.
It's almost easier to see on the page, isn't it? Because the C-T-H-U-L-U, it's almost frightening in and of itself.
That's right.
And he uses that sound within his stories, doesn't it? He distances us from our reality by refusing to use just the words we know.
That's right. Part of the experience of reading Lovecraft is to try and get your head around this language, this strange form of expression. And it's not just the individual words or the alien languages that he's invented. It's actually a matter of his style as well. One of the things about Lovecraft is that he has a certain notoriety for being an appalling writer, which I think is probably quite mistaken. I think there's something quite deliberate in the way that his convoluted, contorted style is again a way of introducing a certain kind of alienation into the reading experience.
Well, there's a quote from him that you have in your essay. There are vocal qualities peculiar to men and vocal qualities peculiar to beasts, and it is terrible to hear the one when the source should yield the other. Again, it's taking us out of our comfort zone with common language.
Yeah, the alien presences, the monsters within Lovecraft, the various entities, one of the things that they tend to have in common is that they inveigle themselves into human communities. They imitate human behavior, human language, and human speech. So in a story such as The Whisper in Darkness, it's precisely about discovering that those around you are imposters and that there's something very wrong with them. This idea of mongrel vibrations, there's something mongrel or mixed about humans, that they have this element of alienness within them, which in Lovecraft often manifests in very disturbing ways. It's well known that he was extremely racist. It could be interpreted, this kind of fear of the alien and this preoccupation with the alien is an inflection of that racist, but it becomes something else, I think. It becomes something more kind of existential, you might say.
That's bad enough, but he goes beyond that, doesn't he? And it is that sound that taking it into an era that all of us find a little irritating. He especially found insect sounds. Well, maybe he found them appealing. I don't know.
I think it's because he's interested in this idea of the strange cosmos in which we find ourselves. That's why I talk about weird ecology. Our lives are entangled with really unsuspected forms of life, ways of being, ways of sensing, new sensations. And one of the ways he figures these new sensations is through imagining a kind of insectile form of life. So insects are his monsters, his creatures. They speak in ways which betray their kinship with insects. So they speak and the language breaks down into a kind of buzzing or rasping, as if they were insects, really.
In this story, in fact, one of the characters makes phonograph recordings, doesn't he? And hears that insectile drone behind the words that he's recording?
That's right.
Ea Shob Nigorat, the black goat of the woods with 1,000 young.
I mean, that's another interesting aspect of Lovecraft, which is not often remarked upon. He's interested in new technologies, in media, and also in the ways in which they are alienating in their own right. So these technologies are used in order to record and to make our lives easier and more efficient, but they also have their alien aspects as well.
And in that story, the beings, are they insects?
They're a strange amalgamation of insects. He describes them as having bat wings and having torsos like flying prawns. They're a strange hybrid, a strange chimera of different animal parts that together make up something that is completely unknown.
This, too, isn't exactly new, although he developed it quite well. This is maybe along the lines of Jussi Parikka's idea of insect media.
Yeah. Well, I think Lovecraft is a source of great interest to many academics in different disciplines today. And I think Jussi is also interested in horror and science fiction and draws on some of those forms of expression and some of those figures in order to think about the reality of our lives with contemporary forms of media, new forms of media. And really enlarging our notion of what media are and what technology is, and maybe other forms of life that share the world with us, are also forms of media, forms of technology.
Well, you talk about Lovecraft's attraction to new media, his understanding of and use of the phonograph recording, for instance, but also his fear of it. There's another story that you wrote about, Beyond the Wall of Sleep, and that one he imagines, what, a cosmic radio apparatus? What's that?
Well, it's a device which facilitates telepathy and access to these realms beyond, to these spaces that are around us all the time, but our senses aren't equipped to detect. So he imagines that a new technology could be invented which plugs us into those weird realms around us, which is a frightening prospect. Often Lovecraft is made sense of in terms of being a kind of response to society and politics around him, the First World War, for example, or changes in capitalism. But also, I think one of the things that's really remarked upon is that the year that he really starts to write his best-known cosmic horror stories, which is 1926, with Call of Cthulhu, was also the year in which the first national network radio station in America began broadcasting. So the great phase of cosmic horror in Lovecraft's writing coincides with really the inception of commercial radio broadcasting, which he never actually overtly discusses, but it must have had a huge impact upon him. Suddenly these radio sets within the home, the tentacles of commerce creeping into everyday life, a kind of living with this new kind of noise, if you like. I suspect that, given Lovecraft's interest in science and technology, was something that filters through into his stories.
Dean Lockwood is the author of the essay Mongrel Vibrations, H.P. Lovecraft's Weird Ecology of Noise. The essay is featured in the book Reverberations, The Philosophy, Aesthetics, and Politics of Noise. Coming up, we'll explore the sounds of capitalism, also known as advertising music, as we continue our hour surrounded by sound. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Hi, I'm TT Book Technical Director Kirill Owen, and this is the TT Book music you've known and maybe loved, maybe hated. Either way, it's time for something new, and we want your help. Here's the idea. Take the first eight notes of our music, F, D, B-flat, C, E-flat, D, B-flat, B-flat again. Play them on any instrument or sample them from here. And remix to your heart's content. Do whatever you like, just so long as it's recognizably our theme. Record your remix as a CD standard WAV file, please. No MP3s. Download our audio and upload yours. Look for instructions on the TT Book homepage. If we use your remix on the air, we'll put you in the credits. Thanks for helping us remix our signature sound.
Have you heard any good advertising jingles lately? Probably not, as the jingle's pretty much gone the way of the dodo bird. But there was a time when you couldn't turn on a radio or a TV set without hearing such classics as You Deserve a Break Today and Plop Flop Fizz Fizz. Remember? Timothy Taylor spent many years studying jingles and other kinds of advertising music. Taylor's an ethnomusicologist at UCLA. He's also the author of The Sounds of Capitalism, Advertising, Music, and the Conquest of Culture. He tells Anne Strainchamps about the very first jingle.
Most radio scholars agree that the first thing that we could call a jingle was for 1926, and it was selling Wheaties. That was a pretty successful commercial, and it saved the Wheaties brand.
Have you tried Wheaties? They're whole wheat with all of the brand. Won't you try?
But in 1926, nobody was thinking, oh, gee, maybe we can write original songs to sell goods and this will be a new thing. It was, you know, just something that Wheaties happened to do that happened to be successful. It wasn't really till the Depression, and well into the Depression, that one particular jingle that was written for Pepsi-Cola was aired. And that one, because it was thought to be so catchy, and was listened to by so many people across the country that the jingle as a sales mechanism became popular. And that was 1939, actually late in 39, and then the jingle lasted for decades.
So was that Pepsi jingle the first one to go viral, in a sense?
Yeah, that's right. And it was translated into 55 languages. Pepsi made versions of it to be played in jukeboxes. They were sort of popular song versions made of it. So you could go out and buy a record, a 78 RPM record.
So you write that at a certain point, advertisers and composers began to get even more sophisticated about how they used music for ads. And they began to compose music to deliberately manipulate emotion or convey certain ideas about products. For instance, you write about a famous TV commercial for Ford cars called Backseat Blues.
Yeah, that was written by the great Mitch Lee, who listeners might know better as the composer to Man of La Mancha, who started a jingle house, as they're called, a jingle production company in the 50s. He had been classically trained by the German composer Paul Hindemith at Yale. He and some other classical composers really wanted to make emotional appeals through music part of what they did. And that hadn't really been done before, believe it or not. I mean, all the jingles, all the advertising music that had been done from the 20s, 30s into the late 50s was almost always very happy, upbeat music, as if nobody ever thought about trying to make music that could be maybe disturbing at the beginning because you've got a stomach ache, but then you take the magic pill and then you have happy music at the end. And nobody really did that, which is odd because in the film industry, all they talked about was what music can do emotionally for what's going on the screen. But in the commercial music world, nobody ever talked about it. I read all the trade press. I looked at tons of archival material. I only found two or three mentions ever of people talking about music and emotion. But it wasn't until these people like Mitch Lee and some other folks in the late, very late 50s, all of whom had classical training, they come along and they say, well, wait a minute, you know, music is powerful. Music can do more than just be happy or be upbeat. And let's use what music can do in a more subtle way to sell product. Mm-hmm. And that's what they did. And of course, that became the norm.
And what was Backseat Blues like?
Backseat Blues was a sort of a vocal jazzy track. It sounds pretty upbeat, the whole thing, from start to finish. But what Mitch Lee did is he changes the meter in it. So when you see people trying to get in and out of Ford's competing cars, and they're scrunching themselves up to do this, he changes the meter and it sounds kind of off. And he does this on purpose. But then when you get in and out of the Ford car, then you get a much, much more straightforward beat.
If the door's not for people, if the floor's not for people, if it twists the sacroiliac of people getting in the back, definitely not a Ford. Definitely not a Ford. Cause Ford gives you headroom, stretch out. You've got leg room getting in and out. You have more room. Ford is proportion for people. Ford is proportion for you. Ford, Ford, Ford is proportion for you.
This is one way in which he was trying to use emotion to sell product. By the 70s, it became much more sophisticated. Lots of different emotional nuances could be used, at least up to a point. In 30 or 60 seconds, there's not that much you can do.
The jingle, as such, kind of began to disappear after a while, and I don't think music is really used quite that way in ads anymore. What caused the decline and fall of the jingle?
Yeah, it was a workhorse in the industry for decades. What I write in the book and what is borne out demographically and you know, backed up by other authors is that when the baby boomers begin to come into positions of authority in the industry in the 1980s, in the advertising industry, they just thought the jingles were corny, and they felt like, why can't we use our own music to sell goods? And you begin to see the rise of the licensing of pre-existing popular music for use in commercials. Maybe most famously or infamously, the use of Beatles' Revolution in 1987 for Nike.
Say you want a revolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world.
That was a huge controversy, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
What happened?
The surviving Beatles sued, but at that point they no longer owned their own music. Michael Jackson's company owned it, so they didn't really have much of a case for a lawsuit, if you ask me, although I'm not a lawyer.
All right. All right.
It's interesting. There's a quotation in your book I flagged because it either seems remarkably cynical or very alarming. You write that there is no popular music today that is not, to varying degrees, advertising music.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, it's partly because the power of the advertising industry is so great, at least in our media landscape, which is dominated by commercial interests, except for public radio, of course. So, you know, commercial interests tend to win out. But also the advertising industry exercises what I think is a sort of an outsized influence on the culture itself. I think the advertising industry's pursuit of the hip and the cool since the 60s has made us all, you know, everybody, at least in the U.S., sort of aware of the hip and the cool. What's the hip new show or the hip new indie rock band or whatever? So I think this ideology of the hip and the cool matters more because the advertising industry feeds off of it and pushes it back on us.
Well, to a certain extent, that's what we're buying, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you look at an ad, the sort of subliminal message often is, we're showing you or telling you what's hip and cool, and if you're hip and cool, you'll understand this.
Yeah, or, you know, you're not going to be hip unless you're in the car like these cool people in the car.
Wearing these particular shoes.
Right. And then also, for these technological reasons, it's much easier now for musicians to move between, you know, writing music for commercials, producing a band, or being in a band. This technology has kind of evened things out a bit. Some complain about that. Some people say that a lot of popular music sounds the same because everybody's using the same software, and I think there's some truth to that.
Well, I was going to ask you, is this good for music or bad for music? I suppose I'm revealing myself as a boomer when I think it sounds like the whole world has become commercial and music is just part of it.
Yeah, it's a complicated question. I think a young musician who wants to try to make a living off of his or her music is probably going to face greater pressures to compromise or do what we used to call selling out than they would have in the past. At the same time, in many places across the country, there's a thriving independent music scene. I almost said indie rock, but it's not always rock. Musicians who don't care if their music gets recorded or not, or gets popular or not. And then there's plenty of musicians who, you know, the music industry has no interest in, like people who just sing or play for fun and who have no ambition of trying to make money off their music. I think all of that is worthwhile. But I do think at the same time that the moment that you decide that you want to try to make money off of your music, the likelihood that you're going to be forced to compromise in commercial directions is greater than it's ever been.
The German engineered Volkswagen Golf. It fits your life, or your complete lack thereof. On the road of life, there are passengers and there are drivers.
Timothy Taylor is the author of The Sounds of Capitalism, Advertising, Music, and the Conquest of Culture. He spoke with N. Strange Champs.
The room is moving, the earth is shaking, there's a lot coming out of my head. For the very first time, for the very first time, there's a lot coming out of my head. I walk to the mirror to see the light bulb on my head. Now we have an idea. Now we have an idea. And to the best of our knowledge, it's a brand new idea. And to the best of our knowledge, it's a brand new idea.
Get a light bulb on your head with full-bodied refreshing to the best of our knowledge. It's 1 hour smartenizing. Visit us online at ttbook.org.
To the best of our knowledge, it's a brand new idea.
If you have questions or comments about the show, you can contact us on Facebook or Twitter, or you can email us through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, we'll meet the pioneering electronic music composer Suzanne Chani as we conclude our hour surrounded by sound. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. What do the Coca-Cola pop and pour sound effect and the Atari video game's audio logo have in common? They were both created by Suzanne Chani, a pioneer in electronic music. Chani got her master's in music composition at the University of California, Berkeley in 1970. And that was where she met a synthesizer designer named Don Buchla. That meeting changed Suzanne Chani's life. She tells Steve Paulson why the synthesizer had such an impact on her.
The synthesizer, even though we didn't call it that back then, gave me control. I could hear the music, I could make it, I could be in it. It was mine, nobody was between me and it. That was very liberating. The other thing was just the romance of the sound. When I was young, I had chronic earaches, and I always had to wear things in my ears and bathing caps, and everything was muffled. And I remember the first time I heard in the swimming pool the sound of the water when I took off my bathing cap, and all that crinkling high frequency and sparkling sound. And to me, just the sound was so overwhelming. So to meet this electronic medium where I could make the sound of sparkling water or whatever else was, you know, just a natural fit. The reason I went into commercial work was so that I could afford to fund my own recordings. Because I had gone to record labels all over the world, you know, in Europe, in the United States, and they would say, well, what, you don't sing? You're a girl. Where's the guitar? So I learned early on that I was going to have to make my own way.
Some of the commercial work you did has stayed with us over the years. I mean, you made some famous audio tracks, one being the Pop and Pour Coca-Cola logo. Can you tell me about that, how you came up with that sound?
I knew that advertising had budgets. I called McCann Erickson, which was the largest agency, repeatedly for a year to get an appointment with the music director and never could. I mean, I was canceled. I was stood up. I was sent away. And finally, I was so angry that when he didn't show up for the appointment, I said, "Where is he?" It was Billy Davis, and they said, well, he's in the studio. And I said, where's the studio? And I marched over to the studio and walked into the session, and they were doing a Coca-Cola jingle. And believe it or not, there was a little space in that jingle of several seconds. And he looked at me and he said, can you do something in there? And I said, yes. And it was for radio. And I said, well, are you going to use it just for this spot or more spots? And so I thought, well, if it's for more spots, I don't want it to have a tonal center. I want it to be able to work any place. And so I thought, well, what about bubbles? You know, because there's no pitch center and you could just sweep up and it sounds refreshing and does all this. So right there, we came up with this idea of doing the pop and pour, which was the sound of the Coke bottle opening. You know, it was like winning the lottery. I had no idea up until then, until, you know, I started getting checks. The musicians' union said, you know, every time it's used in a new spot, you get a check. And they used it in hundreds and hundreds of spots.
Well, how did you actually make the sound? Because you didn't record the sound of liquid being poured, did you? I mean, you made this entirely synthetically?
The thing about harmonics is that they're all musically related. So the harmonic series is a very musical series. And if you pick off these harmonics in a filter, a bandpass filter that is sweeping up, and then you put a little envelope on that as it sweeps, you get the bubbles. Then for the fizz, you take white noise, and the filter at that time could be frequency modulated, and so I would just frequency modulate the white noise with more white noise, and I got the fizz. When you work in sound design, your ear analyzes all the little ingredients. You separate them out, and then you rebuild them. And that was the type of work that I did.
It's fascinating to hear you say this, because I'm guessing that most musicians, most composers probably don't break down sound to this degree.
If you worked with analog synthesis and early computer synthesis, that's how you were trained. There was something called Fourier analysis that said that every sound in the universe can be broken down into sine waves. You know, that there are these building blocks of sound. And then you got something like FM, which said there are musical relationships between certain mathematically related tones that if you multiply them, you get a very musical result, timbres. So in the modular synthesizer, the analog synthesizer, you had modules, and each module specialized. You could add tones, you could filter them. You could filter them in a variety of ways. You dealt with the amplitude. You dealt with all the parameters of sound in an independent way. The pitch, the volume or the amplitude, the rhythmic structure, the envelope. So you analyze sound in order to make it.
And it's a different way of thinking about making music, I think. Because, I mean, you're talking about the science of audio here, sort of the engineering aspect of it. But you're also a musician. I mean, you're someone who creates music, and you're talking about bringing these two rather different areas of expertise together.
Exactly. I have to say, it was a female ear. Because a lot of people looked at the machines as a very macho kind of thing. I used to call it motorcycle talk. You know, when people talk tech. But for me, I wanted that instrument to be sensual and feminine. My job, I saw, was to find the beauty and the sensuality that was inherent in that machinery. My early music was called Waves because I used a compositional form that I thought was very feminine. It was the build, a long build to an audible climax and then a receding. It's a sensual form and it's also a natural form.
And I assume the sexual metaphor that you are playing out is, that's a deliberate analogy you're making.
You can't avoid it. You can't avoid it. It was there. You have to understand, I was in love with that machine. You know, it was.
I also want to ask you about the title track of your Lixiviation CD. First of all, what does the word Lixiviation mean?
Oh, I was afraid you'd ask that. That particular piece was actually done as a film score for an abstract, a recording of Mercury moving. It was sculptor Ronald Mallory, who's famous for his Mercury sculptures. I met Ronald back in my Berkeley days. He was out from New York. Actually, it was his opening in New York that got me to New York. I played Buchla synthesizer at his opening. And this piece, Lixiviation, was a film of his Mercury sculptures. It was very abstract. It was light. And we found that word, really. It had to do with separating alloys or metals. It's a very abstract scientific process, but we liked the sound of it. And it seemed to embody the metallic sensibility of this project, you know, with the Mercury.
So then I guess your challenge is, so how do you turn that into music?
I loved working with picture. And everything was suggested a poetry. You know, an image, you could now make a sound that married that image so perfectly. Ideas could be interpreted in sound. Images could be interpreted in sound. And like very literally, you know, when the Mercury flowed across, you'd make the sound of Mercury flowing. There is must be a sound for that. The piece works, I think, even separate from the soundtrack.
Now, the reissue of your Seven Waves album includes some bonus tracks of the very first album you recorded, Voices of Packaged Souls, which was a collaboration that you did with the sculptor Harold Paris. Can you tell me about that collaboration?
As I look back, because now I have a historical perspective on my life, and I see the origins of a lot of my sound design really were there innocently in the beginning. Harold was a sculptor. He was fascinated by my playing of the synthesizer, and he said, let's do a project together. It was called Voices of Packaged Souls. And he noticed that I could interpret things, and so he gave me a list of poetic titles, the sound of heat, the sound of cold. All of these images, for me, were just inspirations. And so I used early Buchla, I used the computer at Stanford, and I used some music concrete. My job was to make the sound of these things.
Now, one of the tracks that really jumped out at me was Sounds of Bones Growing. Right. Very evocative. Can you tell me about this piece?
Yeah, it really does sound like bones growing to me. You know, it's got that kind of organic stretching quality.
Well, it sounds a little like marching when it first starts, and then it escalates into something else.
Susan Chani is a pianist and music composer. Her early electronic work is featured on an album called Lixiviation. She talked with Steve Paulson. And this is Chani with a piece called Butterflies from her CD Pianissimo 3. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Surrounded by Sound. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Veronica Rickert. Special thanks to Joe Hartke for the Surrounded by Sound remix. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.